listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Listening live at KRUU 100.1 in the Fairfield listening area or online at KRUUFM.com. We live stream. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. Good afternoon if you're listening today and on this beautiful, beautiful December day. And if you're listening on Monday, it's going to be a beautiful day Monday as well.
We're broadcasting live on December 4th, 2015, here in the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, from our solar-powered radio station.
Yes, and it's solar today.
And as we're coming up to the end of the year, just a gentle reminder that KRUU can use your listener support.
Yes.
In financial terms, go to the website, come by the office here on 2nd Street. Just by the railroad tracks.
Yeah, right. Just before the railroad track. Just before the underpass.
Just south of the underpass. And Mom, who do we have today on Writers' Voices?
Well, today we have Julie Long. Now, Julie was born in Fairfield, Iowa, and a typical Midwestern—that's our town—is a typical Midwestern town with a bandstand in town square that just happened to become the center of the Transcendental Meditation movement, causing Oprah to dub it America's most unusual town. For several years, our author lived in Southern California, where she never did find the center of town, before opting for the rural life in Western Pennsylvania, which I know is beautiful this time of year, too. Today she lives on a farm with her husband, extended family, and an English bulldog named Wilson. She seeks to curate calm through yoga, meditation, and energy work, and share what she's learning along the way. And this book is called Rueville, and it is an outstanding book.
No, it's a novel.
It's a novel.
It's a novel.
It's a novel. It's an outstanding. story, and not only for people who used to live in Fairfield and have moved away, but people who still live in Fairfield. I mean, wherever you are.
Or even if you're just curious about Fairfield. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Julie.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you guys.
So how long did you live in Fairfield? From what age?
We moved from Fairfield when I was just after 7th grade, so about 12 or 13.
And I don't know if you knew this, but I went to high school with your sisters.
I have, and Chalkin had mentioned that, and it was such a fun fact to learn. Were you with
Well, Cindy was a year ahead of me. But we were in a music group together, a singing group called Jubilation Singers.
I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Jubilation Singers.
I was so hip.
And then I believe Karen was the next youngest, or Karen. Below Cindy, and she was a year or two younger than I am. But we were in high school at the same time.
And then next in order was my sister Susan, and then I'm the youngest. That's so funny. Cindy will be thrilled that we were chatting.
Oh yeah, where is she now?
She is in Olathe, Kansas.
Oh, not too far away. Great. So, I'm curious as to why you decided to write a novel about Fairfield.
Well,
although it's not called Fairfield in the book. But we all know what you're talking about.
Yeah. It's not called Fairfield in the book, but a couple of things. I mean, I'm very nostalgic for my hometown and my wonderful childhood there, and my time was cut short when we moved. And I just, through the years, have kind of followed some of the coverage of Fairfield, but, you know, that was, you know, before the internet, and so there were times I didn't really know what all was going on in Fairfield and how it had changed. But then once the internet sort of came on the scene and I started following more closely, I just was fascinated by sort of the dichotomy in the town. And at the same time, about, this is like over a decade ago when I first started kind of toying with this idea, my husband and I had a friend of ours from high school. We had moved, and I was on the West Coast, and we had a very good friend who had decided to move back to the Midwest and go to college, and he really just wanted to go find this nice Midwestern girl and settle down there in the town where his or in the state where his family was from. And when and he did that, and then in a few years they divorced, and I kind of felt so bad for him because in my, I'm not sure if this was truth or I kind of, the story I told myself was that he was looking to embrace a Midwestern life, and what she really found attractive about him was that he was from California. She really wanted to get away from the Midwestern life. And so I thought, oh, that's so, you know, I feel for him that he was trying to kind of recapture this simple life only to have it thwarted, and started thinking, you know, what would make that, what would make that even more intense of a change for someone? And then I naturally thought of Fairfield, like, boy, if you went home and not only did this girl want something different than you, but that the town had turned into something different, and what you would do with that. And I think at the same time in my own life, I was exploring a lot of yoga and kind of alternative healthcare kind of stuff, and I didn't really realize it at the time when I was working on the novel, but about halfway through I started realizing, boy, I guess I'm really kind of exploring in this town divided, like, where would I belong?
And the title of your book is Rueville. How did you come up with that title?
Well, it originally I had was calling it Maharishiville, and but it was rather long, and my publisher thought, you know, they did a couple covers with that and thought, you know, it's really kind of long. People might have a little trouble pronouncing it, and so we just sort of thought about some other titles, and I didn't like anything better. And so we were going to go with Maharishiville, but I was still concerned about the length and about just the some younger readers. To me, it flowed easily, kind of like Margaritaville, but Maharishiville, but other people weren't necessarily getting that. And then I realized in the story itself, I have Owen and some of the townspeople referring to the town as Rueville, short for guru, which was a slang. I don't know if it's still used or not, but
it is.
Yep.
I thought it was.
Yeah. I mean, it started out maybe as
derogatory, but not anymore.
But not anymore.
No, huh?
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I was a little. I was worried about that, and then. So I'm glad to hear that it's not derogatory anymore.
Yeah, Ruse are, we're proud of being Ruse.
Yeah, and they've done a great deal for the community. So
So how much of now the main character in Rueville is a guy, so sort of like your friend who went back to look for his Midwest roots, but. Are there other details of it that are autobiographical for you?
Well, Owen and I share some similarities in family history. Owen's father had died when he was in high school, and that prompted his move from town. And my father died when I was 9. In Fairfield, and eventually about 3 years after that, my mother moved our family from town too. So we kind of shared, we both share that sense of childhood cut a little bit short in terms of the Midwestern small town life cut short. And other than that...
Now, Owen's father died in a very unusual way, and your father did, too, in a very tragic way, and I remember that very clearly.
Do you?
Yes.
Yeah. He was, his car was hit by a train as he was crossing the railroad tracks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doctor in Fairfield. So, and he really loved being a doctor in this small town. And so, it was an unusual situation, and also it was very heartfelt when I came back and did a signing in Fairfield. A lot of people came up to me and said, I knew your father, or your father was my doctor, and a couple people have reached out to me to say, you know, that he really helped them with illness or injury, and somebody even said his mother swore that my dad saved his little brother's life, and so it's been really wonderful in that sense to have that connection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Julie, your character Owen kind of resents the fact that his mother moved him to California. Did you ever feel that, or?
Well, you know, I think that level of I was at the age, I still thought it was a big adventure to move away.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some of my sisters probably had that level of resentment, kind of, you know, when you're in the middle of high school and you think, no,
yeah.
I don't want to leave my friends. But, you know, you learn to adapt and get over it and move on to other things. And Owen, unfortunately, really doesn't. Kind of say that idea of that you can't go home again, you know, that Thomas Wolfe quote, because once you've been out in the world, you've changed and your home won't feel the same. But in Owen's case, he has just very stubbornly refused to grow and change out in the world. And it kind of comes from this sense of, for him, this character, this loyalty to his hometown and loyalty to his father, and along with the resentment of having, you know, his high school years there cut short. And so poor Owen actually does all of his growing when he gets back to town.
You know, it's interesting because you know, I moved at that age, also about the same age, early, the beginning of ninth grade, is when my family moved to Fairfield from the east, from the East Coast, from Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was, you know, it was both an adventure and quite an adjustment. And I stayed in touch with friends there for quite a while. Lost touch, but then with Facebook have gotten back in touch with a few. And every now and then I feel like it would be fun to go back and, you know, see what's the same and what's different.
Yes, yeah. And it was fun. We didn't get back very often to Fairfield, but we had a couple trips here and there, and it was really neat. And you're right in that it was, for a lot of years, and me, I tended to lose track with my fellow classmates. I was best friends with Kay Ward and Jolene Horton and Jackie Holmes, who I just learned that she is an author. I'm not sure of her married name now, but. So I kind of lost track more than my older sisters, who were a little, had, you know, another few years of those friendships intact, were a little bit better at staying in touch. And now, certainly, like you said, with the internet and with Facebook, it's been really fun to reconnect with people and have had a few come up to me at the signing, you know, who I literally had not seen since. Probably either, you know, fourth grade, or maybe I think I was back for a visit when I was in seventh grade. And I mean, I'm sorry, not seventh, either saw them in seventh grade or came back in eighth grade.
Wow. So when you decided to, is this your first book, Julie?
This is my first novel.
Okay.
I've co-authored a few nonfiction books. A gift book called Baby and Owner's Manual, kind of instruction manuals that should come with babies, and a couple other things. But they were projects. They weren't, they sort of weren't my baby, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They were very fun, and I enjoyed them. But this was kind of a novel had been stewing in me for a while. So it's my first solo endeavor.
And how long did, when did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I wrote stories when I was in grade school, and I would write them and illustrate them and bind them. So I always enjoyed writing and really enjoyed reading. My mom would take us to the library, and I would just come out with a stack of books. And then I kind of put creative writing sort of on the back burner. I don't know, when I got out of college, I went into advertising, and I was advertising copywriter. It was a different kind of writing, but it was fun, and I enjoyed it. And I just sort of felt a longing to get back to something more in my heart, I guess you would say. You know, I kind of kept thinking that I would get around to doing something, and my sister Karen was ill for a bit and was recovering from some surgery, and I went and stayed with her and just sort of thought, boy, if there's something you want to get around to doing, you better do it, you know? Mm-hmm. You never know, so.
That's true.
Yeah. So, Mom, did you, when you were reading this book, did you see our town in it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, of course. That's why I say anybody... Well, anybody who has lived here, who is living here, or should really, really read this, because you do. You know, it's neat. It
yeah.
really is.
Although it's not, you know, it's not exactly the town.
No,
it's not exactly. But you know, it moves along, and yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Did you come here to do research when you were writing, Julie?
Yes, I came back. Boy. Kind of embarrassing to talk about how long it took me to write this book, but I first went back to research in, I want to say maybe 2003, and I hadn't been back for decades, you know, and it was really wonderful to come back and visit and to research, and I talked to Mayor Malloy, and I visited the high school, Maharishi High School, and talked with some other meditators that, you know, how small-time life goes. My sister's old boyfriend introduced me to some people that he knew, who he worked with, so... it was fun to come back, and I got to see my old house for the first time in a long time.
And where did you live?
We lived at 1104 South D Street, and we lived, when we moved, Bob Rasmussen, who was then the mayor and had been the mayor for a long time, he and his family bought our house. And so as only small town life can be, it's just so wonderful. You know, when we do come back, they say, come on over and see the house.
Oh.
I get to go see my old bedroom and see what they've done with it and, you know, all the beautiful changes they've made. But that's pretty special. That's not just anywhere that you could, you know, go back and say, hi, can I come in and see my old bedroom?
Right.
Well, you know, it makes sense that you started researching in 2003 because when I was reading about various things sort of about the town and the TM movement, that's about when it felt like to me, not today, because we've, you know, the town keeps changing, obviously.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. It definitely is set, you know, in the early 2000s for, you know, kind of in current times, but yeah, little back. And really... what I've done is I took, you know, I started subscribing to the Fairfield newspaper. At first, I got it delivered, you know, to my house through the mail before it was online. And I kind of would just watch and read some of the, I feel like in Fairfield there have been a few instances along the way where maybe different sections of the town, there were at odds.
Right. Right. And you write about one of them, which is the tearing down of the chapel.
Yes.
That's a main. And what year do you know what year that happened?
Oh gosh. I'm sure I will state it wrong if I guess, but it was
Was it before or after you came that first time?
I feel like it was after.
Okay.
But I could be wrong, but I feel like it was after. And so, really, you know, what I did as a writer is to take these little hiccups and invent some new ones and kind of combine them. So it basically took probably 3 decades of issues that have come up in the town and kind of condensed it into a few months in this storyline. So you kind of have to do that to heighten tension and blow it out a little bit and
right.
You know, character make characters look different than anybody really would be.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Julie Long, author of Rueville, a novel. And that's published by Spark Press. Julie, how about you read a little bit from the book for us so that listeners can get a feel for it?
A couple short passages, and I'll just start with one, and we can go from there if you want me to read another.
Okay.
So we established our protagonist is Owen Martin, a male, and this kind of gives insight into his thinking. This is from the early on in the book. When I was a boy, my father liked to share with me various weather rules of thumb. For instance, if a jet airplane doesn't leave a visible trail, you can be fairly certain it won't rain the next day. If it's snowing hard enough that you can't see while driving with your high beams, you can figure the snow is accumulating at a rate of at least an inch per hour. If you feel a chilly downdraft when you see an approaching thunderstorm, the storm most likely will break overhead instead of blowing over. These aren't myths. Here is a weather myth. Cracking your windows during a tornado will equalize pressure and may save your home. No, in fact, it's a useless waste of time, time you could be using to get to a safe place. Myths and folklore, like 6 more weeks of winter if the groundhog sees his shadow, are not reliable. The groundhog, by the way, has only been correct 25% of the time over the last half century. But a rule of thumb, by definition, is based on experience. Midwest living has its own rules of thumb, particularly in a small town. The most exciting thing happening on a Friday night is the high school basketball game. When you sit down to a meal, the main ingredient will be meat, and there will be a good chance the salad contains Jell-O. And when you're ready for a serious relationship, you'll choose a nice, down-to-earth girl who believes in the same things you do. These were the rules of thumb when I grew up in Iowa. They were the rules of thumb I was counting on when I decided to return. I never should have left in the first place. My father certainly wouldn't have. Of course, I should have remembered another rule of thumb, the one about going home. Namely, you can't. Not really. Not even when the hometown is named after your family. And especially not if that town is Martinville, Iowa.
Okay, let's go ahead and read another section.
Sure. So Owen very conveniently gets himself fired from his TV weatherman job in Southern California, which he's been bored to tears with because there's not real weather happening there. And he does indeed decide to come back to Martinville. In his very first few minutes into town, he discovers that the Made Right loose meat sandwich shop has closed. And I'll just pick up a scene from there. So he's just gotten into town and is heading to the farmhouse. Dusk settled as I continued down the street, and I felt melancholy at the loss of the Made Right. What else was gone, I wondered. I held my breath as I looked over my left shoulder to the northwest corner of the square. Was it still there? I let out a sigh when I spotted the sign, Martin Drug. Red script letters stacked down the corner of the building, each in its own square of cream-colored plastic. The background of the inn square was a bit lighter than the others. it must have been replaced at some point, which meant whoever had bought the pharmacy after Dad's death was still running it in some fashion. That drugstore and the Martin Farm had been the founding enterprises of Martindale, each handed down through the generations, ending with my father and his brother. Uncle Phil had gone the farming route while Dad took over the pharmacy, and now there was only the farm. I began to take a mental inventory along my route to the farmhouse. With relief, I spotted the white bandstand in the middle of town square, where a carousel of Santa and his reindeer had circled during the Christmas season when I was a boy. Further down Main Street, I passed the old Dixon Mansion, its lavender-painted turrets now nearly covered by the treetops. For its small size of 10,000 inhabitants, Martindale had a prosperous history, boasting several farm implement manufacturing companies in addition to the surrounding corn and soybean farms. Industry and agriculture have provided a diversity that had kept the town healthy, if not exactly growing. In Martindale's heyday, there had also been a small college, but shortly after we moved, it had lost accreditation. In an effort to increase enrollment, they'd relaxed standards, a move that backfired, and they had to close its doors. If I took a ride at the Dixon Mansion and headed south on D Street a few blocks, I'd first pass the spot where my old elementary school once stood, torn down years ago, and then up D Street Hill, or as much of a hill as you'll find in Iowa, I'd reach the little ranch house in which my parents and I had lived. But I didn't turn right. No, I'd save that for another day. I didn't want to find it painted some hideous color or remodeled or, God forbid, torn down entirely. Instead, I continued past the shaded houses that line Main Street, past the wooded park where Dad used to take us to roast wieners and marshmallows in the fall, past the ball field where I played Little League. All still intact, just spaced closer together than they seemed to avoid traveling mostly by foot and bicycle. After more than a decade in the suburban sprawl of Southern California, the entire footprint of Martindale felt pleasingly miniaturized and manageable. I turned right at the corner where the roller rink stood, no doubt still bolstering young love in its dimly lit domain. Soon the paved road gave way to gravel. "Almost home, girl," I told Stella. The dog pressed her face against the side window, and I cracked it so she could get a whiff of her new surroundings. The air was crisp and cold and seemed to tease us forward. A log fire burned somewhere in the distance, and its smoky scent mixed with the sweet wool fibers of my father's barn jacket that I'd pulled from storage. I turned into the gravel drive of the farmhouse my great-great-grandfather had built. The clapboard house, complete with a storm cellar, was just as I remembered, a little smaller perhaps, and the wraparound porch a bit saggy, but still the same welcoming yellow, soft and warm like sun through an old garage window. My father had chosen the color. We'd painted it together. The summer I'd turned 16, his last summer. The porch light glowed, and through the kitchen window I could see that Aunt Esther had left the light on above the stove when she'd come by to leave the key, and, if I knew my aunt, stocked the fridge. I imagined that light as a twinkle in the eye of some dormant being coming back to life. On the right side of the drive sat the outbuildings, the barn and tool shed. Towering behind them were two silos and a corn crib. Beyond that lay 1,000 acres of fertile land that had been farmed for 5 generations. There'd been no suggestion from my uncle that we sell off the acres. If you were fortunate enough to own land in Iowa, you damn well kept it. I stood by the truck, stretching my shoulders while I let the dog wander, sniff, and do her business. She chose a patch of grass next to the wooden utility pole on the side of the drive. I was pleased to see the basketball hoop still hanging there, though the net was long gone. I took in a deep breath. Though cold filled my lungs, the February air was still heavy with the richness of Iowa soil and trees and all things deeply rooted. I was home.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and that was Julie Long reading from her novel, Rueville.
When you decided to publish, how did you go about finding your publisher?
Well, at first I looked for an agent and came close a couple times, but it didn't work out. And along the way, I had several friends who were having good luck self-publishing,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't I didn't think that was for me either. I just thought it felt like a really big undertaking all by myself, and I didn't want to go it alone. So I sort of kept looking, and I kept revising the manuscript and working with editors. And then a friend of mine was on the advisory board of a new imprint that was coming out, Spark Press, and she knew it was kind of funny. I had literally just finished doing some revision and hadn't told anybody I was done, and it was sort of right before the holidays and a couple years ago, and I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I'm going to let it sit till after the holidays, and maybe I'll try to find an agent again, or maybe I'll self-publish. I don't know, but I'll just remain open. And the very next morning, I got an email from this friend, and it said, I don't know where you are with those edits on that novel that you've been working on, but I think when you're ready, I have a publisher you should meet. So I sort of just, for once, listened to the universe and thought, okay, I said I was going to remain open. So, I got in touch with them and talked with them and at Spark Press. And they're, you know, a small press. They're a new imprint. They come out of a PR firm that specializes in book publicity. They do a lot of work for authors, for traditional publishers, big publishing houses, and also for some self-published authors. And they sort of were at a point where they realized, boy, we're really advising authors on, like, you know, who to turn to for cover art and editing and all of these kind of things. We're really already offering it as a publisher. We should just go ahead and start an imprint. So that's what they were doing. So our paths just sort of crossed at the right time, and I've really enjoyed it working with them.
And the publicity says that Spark Press is an independent boutique publisher delivering high-quality, entertaining, and engaging content that enhances readers' lives with a special focus on female-driven work. And then that's a division of SparkPoint Studio. So that, you know, publishing is changing. And
oh my,
it seems like every year and every time we talk to writers, there's, you know, little different ways to get to become published. And this, you know, your book has the look and feel of a real book. not that self-published books can't, because sometimes they do, but often there's something missing.
Yeah, I agree, and that's also why I just was hesitating. And I had done, you know, a couple of the titles that I had co-authored, the nonfiction titles, we did end up self-publishing, because I think it's different with nonfiction. That's just my opinion. But a couple other titles that I worked on, they had sort of a built-in audience already. They, within this person's business, you know, they wanted this book to pass out to customers or sell to clients. And so they had like a built-in distribution.
Right, right. And that's a perfect opportunity for self-publishing.
Yes, exactly. And that's really key. And I think, you know, what self-publishing lacks is that you don't have, it's really hard to get the professional distribution. So Spark Press was just a great kind of
merger of the two, in a sense.
Yes, and they actually did. It's interesting. They merged with another press called She Writes Press. And She Writes is a press and an online community, and that's kind of where they get their slant towards a lot of female writers. And She Writes Press had been around for probably at least 2 years, 2 or 3 years. And they had already secured Ingram Publishing Services distribution. So they have that distribution already going, which is Ingram is the big name, you know, large publishers and traditional publishers use to get into bookstores. So with those two companies merging, She Writes really had this great distribution already set up, and then Spark Press had this great, strong history of publicity, and you really knew their stuff there. So together, they're a really strong combination.
And they handle all the kind of logistical details of actually getting the books printed as
yes,
well.
Thank God.
Yeah, that's important.
Well, Julie, what do you? What's your day job? Do you have a day job?
really writing now. For a long time, I was still freelancing, doing advertising at work, so that's kind of always been my bread and butter. But over the last few years, I really have pulled back. I'll take on some projects here and there, but really just to focus on writing. I'm in the middle of another novel, and I hope to keep going. I'm a little bit slow of a writer, though. The industry in this day and age, they really, people, they like you to churn out books pretty fast. So, and that's not me, but I still really enjoy the process, and I enjoy the work. So I just kind of have grown to accept that writers come in all shapes and sizes, and you just do, you work the way that you work. So.
Do you write by hand or on computer?
On computer.
Okay. Do you, and I'm wondering, as you were writing Rueville, did you pick your sister's brains or your mother's?
I did, particularly early on when I was sort of, exploring what all was going on in Fairfield. Because I was so young, I really didn't. I knew that the Maharishi had bought the college, and I knew just in broad strokes what was happening, but I didn't really...
Right, because that would have happened before you left, before you moved away.
That happened probably in the last maybe 2 years before
right.
we left. And it was
right.
funny, as I actually started talking with my mom and my my stepdad, Ralph Bolt. So my dad was James Turner, and he was a doctor there. And then when my mom was preparing to move us from Fairfield, it just so happened that Ralph Bolt came back into town to visit, and he had moved away from Fairfield and had been living in Southern California, but his wife had died a couple years prior to this. And somehow they ended up at some social thing, gathering together, and met each other. And so he was a little bit older than my mom, so I always laughed because he was, the way he started courting her was he came over and mowed our lawn.
Hey, works for me.
So for a house of all girls, my sisters usually were forced to go out there and mow, and I just remember looking out and going, who's the guy mowing our lawn? So we still moved away, and they kind of just started dating long distance, and ended up getting married. But so when I started, thinking about this book, I really talked to my mom and to Ralph, what was that like, and what's all going on, and what's the feeling, and just getting kind of, anecdotal stories and their take on things. And it was funny because then when I was talking to my mom said that she had taken the Transcendental Meditation course before we moved. So it was kind
wow.
of fun to learn. And, my sisters didn't remember. They remembered a little bit, but it was more my parents that I got more information from.
Wow. So why did your mom want to move you away from Fairfield?
Well, I think she felt... The bit that we've talked, here and there about it, I think it was just very, it was hard to move on in her life as a widow, as Dr. Turner's widow. Mm. I think to be in a small town it's good and it's bad, right? That everybody knows your personal story, everybody knows what's going on in your life, and... I don't know. I think she just sort of needed a change. And my parents both grew up on farms. My dad was from Oldville, Iowa. My mom was from Clear Lake. And they met at Iowa State. And then my dad went on to medical school at University of Iowa. And he had done, then they married, and they had moved to San Diego for his internship. and or residency, I'm sorry, his residency. And my mom actually really liked it up there, and she, you know, she always said, I would have been probably happy staying there. I thought it was great up there. Wanted to, you know, come back and be a small-town doctor. So, you know, I think, and she, we moved for a year to Colorado, and my mom had a lot of, like, really bad sinus problems, and she knew from visiting some friends in Colorado, the Petersons, who were also from Fairfield, she knew that the dry air was really good for her sinuses, and she felt really good there. So that's where she had moved us. And then we only lived there a year because she and Ralph had started dating, and then we ended up moving to San Diego.
Oh, so she did end up in San Diego.
So she did. She ended up in San Diego.
And you ended up in Pennsylvania. How did that happen?
I ended up in Pennsylvania for love. I met my husband. We were high school sweethearts, and all of his family had been from the Pittsburgh area originally, both his parents, and before they had moved to the San Diego area. And he was born and raised there, but had spent a lot of summers back in Pittsburgh. And he had his uncle that he was very close to wanted him to go into business with him. He had an insurance brokerage. So we thought, let's go back and see what we think of it back there. And I missed the Four Seasons. I was happy to get back to the Four Seasons. I think San Diego, for me, I guess Owen and I sort of have that in common. When you were asking before what we had in common. In that, like, I think it's beautiful, and I'm really happy that I have family there. My mom and two of my sisters are still there. But it's a little crowded for me, just geographically. As I'm talking to you, I'm looking outside my office window, and we live on over 100 acres, and it's just wonderful to have space. And in San Diego, the weather is beautiful, I must admit. Yeah. Kind of take it for granted. When I go back now, my sisters always tease me. They're like, you're such a tourist, because I'm constantly looking up at the sky. And, gosh, it's so blue and bright.
Because weather plays a big important part in the book, because the protagonist is a meteorologist. And so is weather important to you as well? It sounds like it is.
It is. You know, climate interests me, and I don't know if that's just from farming heritage, you know, on both sides of my family. I think I would have loved to live on a farm growing up. We visited my cousins a lot and my grandparents a lot, and that kind of the idea of weather really, you know, mattering more than just factoring into your weekend plans, you know, the fact that weather, you know, for farmers is so important. It was always, you know, always about the weather and what was going on and what was coming down the pike and what the weather meant, you know, to the crops and to the day's work and what they were going to be able to do. So I guess it's kind of in my blood, even though I don't farm the land myself.
Well, Julie, I'm curious, as you were writing, was Owen a meteorologist from the beginning? Was the weather always part of this story, or did that come about later in the process?
That's a good question. I think it was pretty early on that I hit upon that. And because I just, you know, the whole novel, the idea for me was just really dealing in kind of irony, you know. So I thought, I just found it, I liked the idea of that irony of that he's a weatherman. He loves the weather, and he's a weatherman in a city where
the weather never changes.
Yes. In fact, you know, in one part early on, Owen kind of remarks very early on in, like, the first paragraph that, you know, it rarely rains, and that his windshield wipers on his truck had been, you know, broken for more than a year without it being an issue. And then that actually... directly from my husband. He had a truck, and it wasn't an issue for over a year. And it goes in phases, of course, you know, with global warming and all sorts of odd weather things happening. You know, they're getting their share of rains out there now. But
so you talked about your having cousins in the area. Do you still have relatives around here in Fairfield?
Yes. In fact, when I was back in September for book signing in Fairfield, I only got to stay a day because the next day I needed to be up in Clear Lake to a book signing up there, and that's where all of my mom's relatives, most of them are still there. I have, you know, some cousins and second cousins who aren't there. Actually, I think all my cousins are there, but second cousins have, you know, the next generation, some of them have moved away from town. But, yeah, so we get back there quite a bit.
And are you planning any more trips to Fairfield?
I would love to get back to Fairfield because we were only there, I mean, less than 24 hours. As I was reading that passage and I was thinking, I didn't really even get to go look around in some of the shops and all of that. I mean, I had done it, you know, the decade earlier or so when I was there researching, but I would love to get back. And you guys have a lot of exciting things happening. You have great restaurants, and I hear there's just kind of like a whole film industry burgeoning there. And
tons of live music.
Oh my!
You know, we're actually. Believe it or not, I had a guy who's, you know, a Wall Street private equity guy with a lot of connections at the highest levels that I know through business. Said, you know, I've heard of Fairfield. It's like all the indie bands go play there.
Wow.
All the indie musicians stop here because his son is an indie musician out on the West Coast and. So he'd heard about Fairfield.
Yep, Fairfield
is wonderful. Yeah. I mean, more and more as I mention it, you know, out and about, I'm just so excited when, you know, people have heard of it. And I mean, geez, you know, Oprah's been there.
Right. Right. Oh, and all kinds of other people, but we kind of like downplay it. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I can't even, you know, over the years I've heard, you know, Brooke Shields was here and Arnold Schwarzenegger was here. And, oh, of course, Paul McCartney's son, I actually sat next to him at a concert last year.
And really?
Yeah. And I'm like, I think that's Paul McCartney's son. And turns out it was. I talked to him briefly, but.
You never know. You never know who you're going to run into.
And, of course, years ago when Mom had her daily radio station, she interviewed everybody who came through town,
yeah,
including somebody who's sort of peripherally in this book, uh-huh, Doug Henning.
Yeah. Oh, Doug Henning.
Oh.
Doug Henning was the sweetest guy and just so down to earth. And, you know, he was just a wonderful person. He really was. I was very saddened when he died because,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. It's really just, it's a pretty special place. I mean, it's very unique, and where else are you going to find that, you know?
I know. That's true. That's why I say everybody should read this book.
Well, Julie, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process.
Sure.
Because you say you're a slow writer. Do you tend to try and perfect a passage as you're writing it? Or, you know, of the writers I've talked to, there seem to be two main types. One who writes, the first draft is bad, intentionally bad. It's just get it out there on the paper, and then we go back and fix it. And the other type, the first draft, by the time they're done, it's almost complete. And, of course, there's in between. But
yeah,
which of those are you?
Well, I feel like I'm first kind in that. I'm painstaking on writing my first draft, but it ends up being a really crappy first draft. So, I'll go in phases. I mean, I know enough not to be too attached to what I'm writing, particularly like that first chapter, because it's going to change, you know, 1,000 times, and you'll find a new place to start the story and all of that. So I know enough not to get too attached to that. But there are sections that, you know, you you do find yourself very attached to, or just even a paragraph, and you just love it and you want to save it. And sometimes you have to, you know, kill your darlings, as they
say. Yeah. Now, do you know what the plot is, you know, how it's going to end, what the resolution will be? When you start?
I felt like I knew how I wanted it to end. I mean, in terms of, I knew what I wanted the climax to be.
Okay.
I don't know if it's not really giving, it's not giving it away, but I don't know if, you know, and I knew, and that's probably lent itself to Owen's career as a meteorologist.
Right. Yes, absolutely. I thought it was great. I really did, because, you know, I'm reading along. I mean, I had a hard time putting this down. I'm not kidding, because what's gonna happen next? What are we gonna do? You know,
right? And the characters were they were fully drawn, and
real life.
You said that's like such and such.
You know,
a
it's
person.
Funny. I miss them. You know, working on a book for a decade is I really enjoyed hanging out with Owen and Trishna and even Aunt Esther.
Now, in your and who was the other girl? The other
Connie.
Connie, was she based on someone that you actually knew?
No. Connie wasn't at all. I don't feel like all of them have. I think I tend to kind of make characters an amalgamation, you know, of people.
Right.
Sometimes I'll try to picture a person or an actor or somebody just to kind of get the movements down. But in general, I don't know. I just, like Delbert gets his name from my Uncle Delbert, and his personality from an old neighbor of ours, Gail Lyon, who isn't with us anymore, but lived on the corner of D Street and Wilson. I think that's the cross street. And both of those men just were very calm and wise. And my Uncle Delbert is much more of a teaser and a jokester than Delbert in the story. But Mr. Lyon was, I was sort of a tomboy growing up. I think I just decided to be that as the youngest daughter. You know, I thought I'm going to be different in this family. I'll, you know, wear pants and
climb trees
and that kind of thing. Yeah. So I would wander down and see Mr. Lyons and his dog Brownie, and sometimes he would take me fishing. And so, and I think when you take people like that and kind of help enliven a character, it just, you know, they for me, it just like gets them into my heart that much faster, and then they can kind of become whoever they need to become for the story and have their own idiosyncrasies, but it just helps to make that connection.
Now, Julie, in your bio it says that you're that you do yoga, meditation, and energy work. Did that come before you started writing this book, or did writing this book influence your interest in those things?
I was not meditating before I wrote this book. I was just getting into yoga when I started. And so it definitely influenced me. I haven't learned transcendental meditation, at least not formally. I had found, I went to an introductory lecture here in Pittsburgh. I found the center and the teacher and went to a lecture. And at the time, back then, it was pretty expensive. I've heard the prices come down now, but it was expensive. And because I had been doing all this research through these different decades, there was a part of me that was, I know, it's like a little scared. I was a little nervous. Because, you know, I think when transcendental meditation first came on the scene, at least in Fairfield, that was also, you know, that was in the 70s.
Right.
The 70s. Mm-hmm. And there I found once the internet came on the scene, I found different, just, you know, there's just a lot of different stuff covered. And I think my take on all of it is that I think it came of age into Iowa at a time when, people, it was really out there and different. You know, it's not that it was really out there. It just was very different.
Yeah. And now it's almost mainstream.
Pardon me?
Now meditation is almost mainstream.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
well,
so I came into meditation actually through, as a writer.
Ah.
A friend of mine who was originally from India and is became a teacher and living in Pittsburgh, a university professor, and she started a mindful writers group. And so she would lead us through a meditation, and then we would, and we still do. I do this most Wednesdays. She leads us through a meditation, and we journal for about 15 minutes, just kind of clearing the brain, and then we write for 4 hours.
Wow.
In this little diner that has
We have to tell people how to get your book here.
Yeah, we're actually out of time, Julie. I'd love to talk more about that, but we are out of time. Your book is available online.
At any bookseller.
Okay. And you can check out more about Julie at julielongwrites.com and her publisher at ghostsparkpress.com.
And the title is Rouville.
Rouville by Julie Long. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. And please tell Cindy Monica Herr says hello.
I will.
Yes.
And Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
I do. This is for the hero of this book, the protagonist. To live life to the fullest, you must try to do the things you think you cannot do. Does that give people some, you want to read this now?
Now, stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild with James Moore. He is doing a tribute to Scott Weiland of Stone Temple Pilots, and then he'll be talking with environmental artist Cherie Sampson, talking about her Paris climate activities. And see you next week on Writers' Voices.